This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. It's time to talk about vehicle maintenance, and that means Jim Ward is back with us. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Jill. Good morning.
Good to hear from you. Jim is retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, and he was with the company for 36 years. We're going to start out by talking to him about air conditioning, your car's battery, maybe coolant, and some other summertime concerns. Are you preparing to pull your camper or boat in the near future? Are you wondering if your vehicle is maybe powerful enough? Or maybe you've got some problems with your vehicle that you need to talk to Jim about. Well, we'd like to hear from you, so give us a call. Lines are open, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Jim, it's so good to have you with us again.
It's great to be here, man. I'll tell you, this weather is just the perfect summer weather. I can stand it to be like this the rest of the summer. And it's got to have people thinking of road trips and vacations.
I agree with you 100%. And I just got back from Door County last weekend. We did our show up there on Tuesday, and the weather was a little warm, but it was pretty darn nice, and there were a lot of people out there. What's the first thing that we should think about when we're going to go on a road trip as far as our car goes?
Well, you know, it can seem kind of complicated on what all you might have to do. The one thing to really simplify all of this is that your car, every car, has got a recommended maintenance schedule. It's got a schedule of things that are supposed to be done at certain intervals, time or mileage intervals, whichever comes first. If you do those things and you follow the recommendations that come up out of the inspections that are done as part of that, you're all set. There really isn't a whole lot more that you need to do. You know, there are lots of little things that can make, trips more comfort on the simple side of things. You know, those covers that go on the inside of the windshield to keep your vehicle from being molten when you get back in on a hot day, not a bad idea. Something that really isn't part of vehicle maintenance, but, you know, I anymore I really wouldn't consider being without it. Some kind of roadside assistance plan, whether it be a AAA or something that if you do have that unfortunate breakdown, I mean, you could do everything you need in terms of, you know, preventative maintenance, but things still happen. You can still hit something and end up, you know, hit something in the road and have a flat tire or just have an unexpected breakdown. So having roadside assistance that would cover towing to a repair facility can and often they'll also cover, alternate transportation, possibly even lodging if your vehicle's broken down. That's something important to consider, particularly if you're not driving a brand new vehicle. Those are some important things that you definitely want to consider. But if you haven't taken your vehicle in, if it's behind on regular maintenance, I know so many people in my own circle of friends don't drive as much as they used to, either don't have to commute for work as much as they used to. And so, you know, those things kind of slip to the back of your mind. So if you're planning a vacation or a road trip and taking the car, take it in, get that scheduled maintenance done. You know, just make sure that everything is ready to go.
That's really good advice. For those of us who have a car that, you know, light up and say, hey, it's time to bring it in and here's your code, is there anything else we have to do other than, you know, call in and say, hey, do this code? Should we be concerned about anything else that may not show up there?
Well, you know, I don't know if you're talking about just a warning light, like a check engine light with a code. I mean, again, the scheduled maintenance is something that if that's up to date, you know, you've done your due diligence. There's always other things to worry about.
Well, yeah, I mean,
the unexpected can come up. Ultimately, if you have some kind of a fault and a warning light comes on and there's a code associated with it, that should definitely be followed up on, checked out, and repaired or adjusted as needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, my car tells me when it's time to get the oil changed or it's time to rotate the tires, and I'm always thinking, have they thought of everything, or is there something that I should be aware of? So that's where I'm coming from.
You know, when it comes to regular maintenance of the cars, really, you know, cars have less maintenance, preventative maintenance, than they ever had.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you follow that schedule and get those things done, there really aren't a lot of other things. I mean, they're going to look at the tires, so that if your tires are getting near the wear limit, and, you know, in Wisconsin, when we think of tires, the first thing most people think of is snow, but you have to have enough tread to get you through those rain showers and through the wet roads, and have good traction there as well. So, but that's something that is inspected as part of general maintenance. They'll look at the tires, they'll check the belt for the air conditioning. I mean, with air conditioning systems, there isn't a whole lot of preventative maintenance. You probably have a pollen filter that's in the dash for your ventilation system that's part of it. A lot of more and more vehicles have electric air conditioning, so they don't have a belt that drives it off the engine. But, if it's a conventional air conditioning system with a belt, that'll be checked as part of that scheduled maintenance. The unexpected can always happen. It can. And I've had the classic back in the late 80s in a Volkswagen camper van taking a trip down to Florida. I had a starter failure. I had a fuel pump circuit failure. And, fortunately, I was able to get, manage without having to get any assistance to get those systems working and got back home. But, it definitely can. I'll just never forget how I felt thinking, I got the family out here. It's hot. It's summertime. You just don't want to be in that situation. So anything you can do preventatively, whether you do your own maintenance or whether you're going to take it in, don't put it off. Get it done. Go out there with the reassurance that you've done everything you can, and then have that roadside assistance plan just in case.
Absolutely. And even if you, like some people who I won't be mentioning, lock their keys in their car way too often, it works for that too, because that can really ruin a vacation.
Oh, it sure can. It sure can. I've worked with people that have had that happen and ended up, they had a child in the car, goodness gracious, and it was just a stop at a gas station, ended up having to throw a brick through the back. Obviously you could call a locksmith or something, but the unexpected can happen.
Yep. And that locksmith, they're busy. That can take a while. So
yeah.
Let's just pop over to the phones right away. We've got Tom in McGuanago who has a question for you. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, hi, good morning. I just wanted to say, I know when you worked at Smart Motors, you worked on Toyotas and stuff, and I guess I do have one complaint about my Lexus is it's too good. For some reason, it keeps running so well that I kind of skip maintenance. My basic question is, my Lexus RX now has like 214,000 miles, and I have not done anything with the transmission. From what I've heard, if it's gone that far, I should just leave it alone. Is that correct? In other words, not getting the fluid changed. Yeah.
Right. Getting the fluid changed, and it basically it's going to be this is probably an automatic transmission vehicle, so it's going to be a automatic transmission fluid flush. There's no I don't buy into that if it's never been done, don't do it. Because it basically varnishes build up. The fear is in that theory that it's going to break something loose and it's going to go to some other part of the transmission and clog it up, and you're going to have a major repair. I've not really seen that happen, and if that scenario is going to happen, it's just as likely to happen whether you get the transmission fluid flushed or not. It is amazing how well vehicles could do it again, how little maintenance there is. And you can run the risk and not do the scheduled maintenance, and some people, actually probably the majority of people, aren't going to have a problem. But the expense, particularly of something like a transmission, just isn't worth risking. I would do it, and at 214,000 miles, I wouldn't have the least concern at all. If it's never been done before, I would still go ahead and do it.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question, Tom. Now, speaking about transmissions, and we were talking about maybe, pulling a boat or camper, I've heard of a transmission cooler. Is that something that's beneficial if you're going to be doing that?
It's something you definitely want to have. Most vehicles, when they're purchased, will be available with an optional tow package. A lot of trucks just come with it equipped with a tow package. That's what they're designed for. But other vehicles may have an optional tow package, and part of that tow package is going to be a transmission cooler. And if you're towing, that is going to be necessary because the transmission is going to work harder, the fluid is going to get hotter, and it's going to break down quicker. And the cooler the fluid is, the more it can handle that load and that extra work. It's not impossible, but it's not very practical to put a transmission cooler on a car after it's produced. That like I said, it can be done, but that's not a very easy thing to do or inexpensive thing to do. So if you're thinking, if you're looking at vehicles, you're thinking about buying a vehicle with that purpose in mind, you want to double check that and not think, well, I'll just add that later, because it could be done, but it's not practical and it's not cheap.
Ah, great. I've also been seeing some ads lately for companies that will let you rent a trailer and a hitch. Is that a good idea for cars that, you know, maybe shouldn't? I mean, are there cars that shouldn't be pulling something?
There definitely are cars that are not designed to tow anything, and that's a bad idea to try to tow with it. And, you know, a hitch should be a proper frame-mounted hitch that is the right grade of hitch for the weight that you're going to be pulling. You know, it affects how your vehicle handles, how quickly it's going to stop in an emergency, and, you know, and frankly, having what you're towing hitched right in the front and having the weight distributed properly is key to, I mean, if you've ever been going down the road and see somebody towing a trailer, that trailer swaying back and forth,
yes.
You don't even want to get anywhere near that vehicle. You know, it's that can be a really dangerous situation. So it's just not something you want to toy around with and do halfway.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. We've got Kristen Adams that has a story for us. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Jill. Long time no here.
I know.
I have a very fun story. This happened a long time ago. I was on my way out to Idaho driving a friend who was actually taping somebody for a national public radio show, and we had to get there on time. And we pulled into the other side of Minnesota, and the car overheated. So we pulled into a gas station and popped the top. And this very nice Mormon man came over and disconnected our thermostat from the air conditioner thingamajigger, and the car started right up, and we went on our way. It was about 99 degrees outside. It was the end of August, and we were coming back from our gig, and they had put both sides of the freeway on one side of the freeway because they were pouring asphalt out on the prairie. It was just blistering hot outside. We had all the windows open, and this woman screamed at me from the truck, "Hey, Wisconsin, got any cheese?" They were having lunch. So I pulled across the median and backed my car up against their truck and unloaded our cooler for them, and then we drove away, and we made it all the way home without anything else happening. So the moral of that story is always carry Wisconsin summer sausage and cheddar cheese in your car just in case.
I got to put that in my emergency kit right now.
I was going to say, I don't think that was on your list, Jim.
It wasn't. I made a correction.
Thank you, Chris. We appreciate that. If you've got a question or a comment, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always send us an email. That's talk@WPR.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. Our guest today is Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota. Make sure to stay with us, because after 12:30 today, we're going to hear about the Madison chapter of a national women's motorcycle group, which should be really fun to hear about. Are you a motorcycle fan, Jim?
You know, I don't have a motorcycle. I haven't ridden a motorcycle in years. My little sister had a motorcycle. I think she still does it and rides it, though. So she will probably tune into that.
Love it.
That's great.
I love it. So let's get back to some of the things we should really be talking about before in the summertime. And I think the biggest thing, at least for me, is making sure that AC does not break, like Chris was just talking about. So how can we tell if maybe it's on the verge?
Well, that isn't the simplest thing. If you're you know, looking the car over, if you are knowledgeable enough to know to be able to identify your air conditioning system, when you look under the hood, one of the things you want to look at is where the hose fitting connections are at the compressor and at the condenser out on the hood. Typically, one of the most common reasons an air conditioner will stop working is because of a loss of the gas, the refrigerant, and that gas itself is an odorless gas. You wouldn't see it, but there's an oil in the system, and if there's a leak of that gas, typically there's going to be an oil, and that oil is going to be noticeable at a fitting. You know, most of the time, the first thing people notice is just that the air is not cold anymore, and that's it. And someone has to start looking from that point to find out where it is, and actually, you know, diagnosing a leak can be quite a bit more complicated. But on the simple side of things, taking a look at those hoses, see if you see any sign of oil. You know, one of the other unexpected kind of common things that I've seen to cause air conditioners to quit working, even though the air conditioners work fine, is that air conditioners take a lot of condensation out of the air, and it's actually caught in a little pan, you know, about the size of a small dish pan in the dash of the car that's got a drain hose that goes out of the car, and it drifts on the ground underneath it. If you run your air conditioner on a really hot, humid day, you can actually look under your car and see a drip, drip, drip of water coming out from that, and that's normal. It should. But sometimes that hose gets plugged up. It can happen from different things. It can happen from underneath. It can happen from debris coming into the ventilation system, like tree seeds and tree bits and stuff like that from the top side. And if that gets plugged up, you might not notice with other ventilation functions, but the air conditioner starts to run, and if it starts to fill that pan up with water, it could even splash out on your foot, but it ultimately does is puts about half of the air conditioner's dash unit, the little evaporator that's in the dash, underwater, and then the air conditioner is not going to seem to be working very well. So that's something that, you know, that you can also check yourself, is that when you're running the air conditioner on a hot, humid day, you should see that water dripping out from underneath. If you smell kind of a musty water smell in the car, you know, or have noticed some dampness on the carpeting on either side, the driver's side or the passenger side toward the center of the dash, could be a sign that that is plugged up. And again, it's not really a complicated thing to fix, just to clear out that drain hose. But it's one of the more common things that we see over the years, where everything on the air conditioning is working fine, but you're not going to get much cool air out of the vents if that's plugged up.
Okay, that seems like an easy fix, so I like those.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone. Sarah in Duluth, what can we help you with?
Hi. My question is, in today's world of brand new vehicles, I've been given conflicting information as to when to get my first oil change done. I've been told anywhere from 500 miles to wait to the 5, 6,000 mile. So I would like to know his advice on that.
Well, I don't think there are any manufacturers any longer that make that recommendation around 500 miles, but in all fairness, that once was a thing, that cars were built and initially had something called break-in oil in them that really was only meant to be in there a short period of time and then changed out. It's been decades since that's been the case. But, you know, there's sometimes that old-school train of thought doesn't change, and, you know, you can hardly ever change oil too often, but it really isn't necessary to be done at 500 miles. Many vehicles will have a 5,000 or a 10,000 mile interval, and I've always been a proponent for doing the maintenance schedule as the manufacturer recommends. Manufacturers often will have two schedules, one for severe climates, and they'll have definitions on what temperature ranges and conditions make for a severe climate, and if you live in that situation, then you'd follow that severe climate. Wisconsin typically has been more of a severe climate state, and oil changes on engine are one of the few areas where, you know, I often say you don't need to do things more often than manufacturers say. Depending on where you go, you may get recommendations that are more frequent and more maintenance than what the manufacturer recommends, and that really hardly ever is necessary. But when it comes to oil changes, I like a 5,000-mile interval. And one of the reasons for that is that even newer vehicles can develop some oil consumption. It's not likely to happen in the first 20,000 miles, but you know, if you are in the habit of checking your oil level, which is recommended to be done, and I don't know that hardly anybody does that anymore, then you can probably go to the 10,000 mile interval. But if you're someone who says, I'm never going to check that level, you know, it's not going to be checked until I take it in to have it changed, I would seriously consider doing it more like the 5,000 mile interval. But yep, that is the, you know, the most frequently that you really should have to do that.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. Let's go to Tom from Dresbeck, Minnesota. He's got a question that relates to that. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, yeah, you kind of answered my question, but I get my wife's hand-me-down vehicle. She always drives the new one, and I get it passed down to me.
I can relate. I always did that.
Yeah. So I have an 02 F-250 and a 2000 Ford Mountaineer with a V8. Now, this 5,000, you know, it went from 3,000, religiously we did it, to 5,000, now 10,000. But 5,000 seems to be the normal. Is that still okay with the older vehicles?
I believe it is. I do. One of the most important things you can learn to do to take care of your car, to prevent major, major breakdowns, is to learn to check your oil. Because as you start to get, you know, over 100,000 to 200,000 miles, it wouldn't be unusual for an engine to start to use some oil. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with an engine burning a little oil as long as you keep up with it. And when it gets a quart low, add oil. Engines are designed to run okay and have enough lubrication when they get to be down to about a quart low. Much more than that, and it's too much, too much loss of oil, and you're starting to take a chance of not having enough lubrication. You know, one of the biggest things I got to emphasize about oil consumption too is that perhaps you start checking your oil and you say, okay, well, yeah, my engine uses a quart of oil in 2,500 miles. No big deal. No repair needs to be done. You just need, assuming it's not leaking out, it's okay for an engine to burn that much oil as long as at 2,500 miles when it's a quart low, you add a quart of oil and then just keep your eye on it. But one thing to know is that engines that do burn oil, even in that okay range, if you take off on a highway trip where normally your day-to-day commuting's in town and you may drive 15, 20, 25 miles in a commute, taking off on a highway trip and putting thousands of miles on the car in the course of a few days, that engine is likely to consume oil at a much higher rate than it did just in your normal commuting. So if you are someone who has an older vehicle or a vehicle that consumes a little oil, just be aware when you go on a trip. Check it more frequently. Maybe check it every time you get gas or every other time just to keep up with that, because you might burn a quart in 2,500 miles in your normal commuting. It might burn a quart in 1,000 miles on a highway trip. So just something to be aware of. But, yep, on the oil change interval, 5,000 miles should be sufficient for both of those vehicles.
Okay, thanks for the question, Tom. If you've got a question for Jim, our number is 800-642-1234. And we do have open lines, so go ahead and dial real quick, or press those buttons, I guess I should say, these days. Or you can send us an email, too, and that's talk@wpr.org. So, Jim, one of the things that people don't even think about in the summer for some reason, even though it's actually, we're tougher on it in the summer, is batteries. Why is the hot weather so hard on our batteries?
Well, the chemistry in the battery breaks down more under heat than it does under cold. A battery is more challenged to start a car in the cold, but batteries fail. If you look at a battery failure chart, like a map of our country, what you'll find is that batteries last the shortest amount of time in the lower, fifth of the country. And that bottom part of Texas and that bottom part of the country are so hot, they'll have the shortest battery lifespan. And actually, in the cooler weather, colder climates, the batteries actually last longer. And that's it, is that the heat is what causes the breakdown of the chemicals in the battery and causes them to fail earlier.
So should we be thinking now with the way that our climate has been changing, it's going to be a lot hotter, a lot sooner, and a lot longer. So how should we think about our battery then as far as replacing it? Should it be more often?
Well, one of the beauties of regular maintenance, and one of the things that is typically going to be done on a multi-point inspection, is they're going to run a battery test. And battery tests don't just have the ability to tell you if your battery's good or bad today, they have a pretty good ability to predict if that battery is starting to fail and going to not last you 6 months to a year. So getting that kind of a battery test done is gold. And honestly, it won't catch every single battery failure, because batteries fail different ways for different reasons. But the most typical way they fail is a breakdown of the chemistry inside the battery, and that test will help determine if that's what's going on there. So, that is really what you want to have done there. Batteries used to have maintenance where you'd have to add some distilled water, but almost all batteries in vehicles now are maintenance-free, and that's not really a concern. Corrosion buildup on the battery terminals is something else that should be looked at and would be looked at on a multi-point inspection. And if necessary, cleaned off and an anti-corrosive put on them, just to make sure that even if the battery's good, you get that power from the battery through the cables to the starter and the rest of the vehicle. That's something that should be part of regular preventative maintenance.
Okay, great. Let's go to the phones and George and Racine. What's your question?
I've got a Ford F-150. It's a 2020. It's only got 26,000 miles on it, and I need to replace the rotors on the vehicle. The only thing I can think why the rotor is warped is maybe somebody riding the brake on it while it's being driven, or the assembly in the factory wasn't correct. The other question I have is there a way that I can hook up maybe a light to the dash to alert somebody that they have their foot on the brake while they're going down the road, and I'll take my answers off the radio.
Well, the brake rotor, it sounded like, if I understood right, that's got 26,000 miles on it, and one of the and I kind of got the impression too that what you're getting is a pulsation in the brake pedal, which is an indication that the brake rotors are no longer flat, that they've got a warp to them. I mean, this is analogous to an old vinyl record album. I'm aging myself here, but you get warped and you'd see that go up and down. One of the more common things that can cause, one of the most common thing that will cause a brake pulsation in the brake pedal is just rust buildup on the brake rotor, and it builds up primarily everywhere except where the brake pad is, so you end up with kind of a low spot there. And if this is a vehicle that sits a lot, and a 2020 that's only got 26,000 miles, I'm guessing sits a lot, can be the cause of that. It may be, you know, a good idea to take that, you know, if it sits for days at a time, and I don't know if it does, but at 26,000 miles on a 2020, it's either driven just a couple miles every day or it's not driven every day. But when you do take it out and drive it, getting it up to highway speed, and I'm not saying, you know, brake hard enough to lock up wheels at all, but just give it some more harder braking. It helps, that friction helps grind some of that oxidation off that can eventually lead to the kind of brake pulsation that can eventually lead to having to replace those brake rotors. In terms of the second question, I'm not aware of a dash light system that can be put on to warn you when the brake has been applied from inside the car. It's possible someone makes something like that. You could Google that and find out if somebody does out there. You know, there are those left-footed brakers out there. It does drive me crazy going down the road when a car is obviously not braking or decelerating. You see the brake light coming on every few moments. It's not the best technique of driving to drive that way, or to, you know, to two-footed drive and have one foot on the brake pedal all the time. It's just that also would not cause the brake rotor problem. It might cause your brake pads, the brake linings, to wear down more quickly, but it really wouldn't cause a problem with the brake rotors. But yeah, I'm not familiar with the system that does that. Not sure it's not out there, but yeah, that's a driving technique you want to avoid.
Okay, thank you, George. Ken and Toma, you're up next.
Back to the oil change system. On newer cars, when you go through the onboard stuff for trip ticks and everything else, one of them comes up as oil, as far as 50% still there, 90% there, 30% there. How accurate is that, and what is the proper low to go down to, 25% or 10%? Well, how far low on those are those?
Back, some of those systems may work differently than others, but for example, on my Silverado, it's a 5,000-mile interval, and it'll tell me the remaining life of the oil. All it's doing is counting down the odometer. It's just counting it down 5,000 miles. So when it gets to 1,000 miles remaining, it's when it's gone 4,000 miles on the oil, it's going to say 20% remains. And when it gets down, you know, so it basically is just counting down the oil. I'm not familiar with any system on a car that has any kind of chemistry check or anything that actually checks the quality of that oil. So to my knowledge, those systems are counting down the miles, which you could do yourself. It's just a different way of presenting the information to you that your vehicle is getting closer to that mileage.
Did that help you out, Ken, or did you have another question or comment?
That doesn't answer that question, but the previous gentleman, I recently had a vehicle where they found that I was having a pulsating, and a caliper was loose and or misaligned. And when they fixed it, no more problems.
Yeah, if a brake caliper can hang up or have malfunctions, that can definitely affect the brake rotors. There's a lot of interplay between various components in your brake system. And again, that's something that's looked at as part of maintenance inspection. There's two brake linings on each wheel brake, so eight on a car, two on each side in the front. And those should wear evenly, and that's one of the things that they check. If you have one of those kind of brake problems, they can often catch that early because one of those brake linings will be more worn than the others. But if it continues and goes too far, it can cause heat to build up that can ruin those rotors and end up being a more expensive brake job. So, again, you're always hoping that those things will be caught on the preventative side rather than on the breakdown side.
Okay. Thanks, Ken. Brent in St. Paul, what can we help you with?
Another two questions. I have a 2014 Ram 1500 I thought brand new. It has only has 49,000 miles on it. And ever since I bought it, this heater doesn't really work that great. And I noticed that from the time the truck was built to the time I bought it, it was 14 months had gone by. I was wondering if that has anything to do with it.
And Brent, I'm sorry, I caught most of it, but I didn't quite catch what the issue is with it. 14 Ram, 1500 with 45,000 miles. What is going on with it?
The heater doesn't work that great in the wintertime.
The heater?
In the wintertime, of course. And ever since it was brand new, it's been that way. And the truck was manufactured to the time I bought it, it was 14 months had gone by, so it just... Basically, since it was built till I bought it, it sat for 14 months. I was just wondering if that had anything to do with it.
I wouldn't think that would have anything to do with it. But when you say the heater doesn't work, you mean that the air just never seems to get as warm as you'd like?
Right.
That's it? Well, you know, there are different things that could cause that. One of the things that I've seen cause that in a vehicle is just a slightly low antifreeze level. If you are half a quart low on antifreeze, your engine won't run hot. It'll run just fine. The temperature gauge will be right where it should be, but your heater uses the antifreeze from the hot engine, the hot antifreeze, to produce the heat that you feel in the car. And, you know, you could go a long, long time. I mean, at 45,000 miles, on a 2014, it's 10 years old, so the antifreeze probably should have been flushed now by schedule, but with only 45,000 miles on it, it may not have been done. I might not have done it with my own with only 45,000 miles on it. And it could have gone all that time, a half a quart low, and your heater would work, but it wouldn't work as well as if it were full, and it really wouldn't cause any other problems. It wouldn't overheat. It wouldn't run too warm. So that's the easiest thing to check. That would be the most optimistic I could be that that's what's going on. It's also possible that the thermostat's not quite right. The thermostat is what controls the flow of that antifreeze and makes sure that it stays in the right temperature range. And it wouldn't have to be off very much. Again, it wouldn't be enough of a malfunction to cause problems or anything else. But, you know, there is some testing that can be done. But, you know, man, I hope for you that it's as simple as checking the antifreeze level. After all these years, you know, I don't know. It could very well be there's a lot of different things that could affect your heater and its performance, but those are two of the most common things I've seen over the years.
Okay, good luck, Brent. Ruth in Chippewa, we've got another oil change question. Go ahead, Ruth.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Okay, she's there. I have a diesel RV, and I change the oil every 10,000 miles, but now I don't drive that far anymore. How often do I have to change it? What do I do? Do it every year or do it every so many thousand miles?
I would go with a one-year interval if you're not driving that mileage in that time. You know, you may not put many miles on it, but condensation builds up inside that crankcase, and that's what you're really getting out of there by doing it once a year. If you're not going to put the miles on, go by a time interval like that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Our guest today is Jim Ward. He's retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota. Do you have questions about your vehicle? Lines are open. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk, Diana Allfuth is back. She'll talk about what to do with all those diseased leaves and branches we take out of our garden. And we'll also take a look at rock gardens with our guests from the Allen Centennial Garden. That's tomorrow, starting at 11, right here on WPR News. But today we are talking about vehicle maintenance, and we'll go right back to the phone. Willow in Madison has a question. Go ahead, Willow.
I have a 2020 Tacoma, and the hands-free phone system doesn't work anymore. It worked; it was okay the first year or two, and then after, it just wouldn't do as I request. And I'm wondering why. What can I do about it?
Well, you know, the connectivity between a phone and vehicle's radios are a simple enough system, but they can also be one of the most frustrating. There are certain protocols that to get these to work together that are necessary, and one of the most common is that the phone and the radio need to have the most up-to-date software. And, you know, so if the software is not updated, they can get us into the point where they wouldn't even work together anymore. So one of the things I would check is that your phone does have the latest software, and that your radio, if there are updates that have come out for the radio, that has the latest software. And then beyond that, one of the things I would recommend you do, you could go to any dealer, and typically dealers have a specialist who kind of deals just with that connectivity issue. Usually they're the people that deliver the brand new car so they can show people, you know, how to make that connection initially in the first place. But they're typically very knowledgeable about, you know, about the various protocols from different types of phones and different radios that might be in any given vehicle. So, you know, I would check those updates first. If they're not updated to the latest software, get that done. If they are updated to the latest software, then I would go to a Toyota dealer and just see. Typically, you know, at Smart Motors, when I worked there, we really didn't charge for that. Someone come out and just try to help you get them connected, and they may be able to find a trick that you haven't tried yet. So that is my recommendation there, Willow.
Okay, thanks for that call. So updating the operating system on your radio, is that something that you can do yourself, or do you need someone?
It depends on the radio. Some of them are able to be done over the air, and you can do it yourself, and others have to be connected to a system at the dealership or to a piece of equipment.
Sure.
That's what has to be a dealership. But connected to a piece of equipment you may not have at home
right,
to be able to update them.
Yep. Okay, sounds good. Let's go then to Barbara in Grand Marsh. Hi, Barbara. What's your question?
Hello. I have a 2001 Mustang. It has 116,000 miles on it. I like to check the oil, and I hear different stories from men, because I'm a woman. Do I check it when the engine is cold or hot?
Well, with the engine oil, I'm going to say it doesn't make any difference at all. Check it cold, check it hot. If people would just check their oil, I would be happy. Now, other fluids in the car are a different story. You know, for example, automatic transmission fluid is something that you check when the engine's hot. You don't check it cold, the fluid expands, and you're going to get a different reading hot to cold. But with engine oil, obviously things expand. It might expand a little bit, but it isn't the same as something like transmission fluid. So cold or hot, you're not going to get an inaccurate reading with engine oil. As long as you check it, you're going to be good.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. If you've got a question for Jim, our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lines are open. Or you can send us an email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. And we did get an email from Amy in Milwaukee. She's wondering, how often do car computers need to be updated? Do you need to take them to the dealership to do that? And how often? And how much would it cost? She's heard that some dealerships do it during an oil change, but if you don't take your car into the dealership for oil changes, then how is it updated?
Good questions, and the answers to that question are all over the place. And and what I mean by that is that, as I had mentioned before about radios, some vehicles' onboard computers, along with the radio, which is just another computer, update by themselves automatically, and the newer the vehicle is, the more likely that is to be the case, where you wouldn't need to go in anywhere and wouldn't, you know, and in terms of intervals, it can vary greatly. It can be something like navigation systems may have updates with newer roads and newer information only about once a year, whereas other types of software, like the engine management system, might have an update come out any time they realize there's a problem and say, oh, you know, this little glitch, we can tweak this a little bit, we'll come out with software. It could happen every 3 months, you know, on a given vehicle. But it does vary. Some vehicles, it can only be done at a dealer or repair facility that has, equipment that they can connect to it and download it to it, essentially. Often, you know, on newer vehicles, if it has to be done manually like that, it can be done on a flash drive where they don't even need a big piece of equipment. They just download it from the manufacturer, from a computer, to do that onto a flash drive, take that flash drive out to your vehicle, and can download to your vehicle that way. But there's really quite a wide variety of ways it's done, and quite a wide variety of intervals from which those things we'll get updates from just a few months to, you know, once a year or even every 2 or 3 years. So that's the kind of thing where really you're just going to have to research your specific vehicle to find out how it's done and how frequently it would be necessary.
Okay, thank you, Amy. Next, we have Jeff in Hazelhurst with a question. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yes, I have a 2014 Toyota RAV4, and my air conditioner is very intermittent. It works really great, ice cold air, and then for another 300 miles, it doesn't work at all, then it works again. It doesn't seem to have a pattern I can figure out. And I did have it looked at, and the guy said, well, you need to replace the whole air conditioner. That just seemed a little extreme to me, that because it was like $2,000. So any other ideas?
Well, I'm going to agree that that seems kind of extreme. I don't think the whole air conditioner is a problem. I mean, obviously, you know, the good side of it is that you don't have a leak. Obviously, the refrigerant isn't running out. When it does not cool, I take it the fan still blows. It'll blow air, but it's just not cold. Is that right, Jeff?
Yep.
Yeah, so
warm air.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, because if anytime the fan doesn't work, the air conditioner's not going to work either. So there's something intermittent going on here. There's some kind of a sensor. When you had it looked at, was it acting up? Was it in a state of not cooling when they looked at it?
I think it was, yes. And I couldn't help that, you know, because, of course, you can't take it in, like, when it's working.
Right.
It just didn't work out.
Right. If you take it in when it's working, they're probably not going to be able to make much headway. I'm not sure if the – I mean, it just seems like a very, very unlikely need to say you have to replace the whole air conditioning system. You know, there's a component somewhere that's got an intermittent problem. There's going to be some kind of electrical problem that, you know, it could be a relay, it could be a connection somewhere, and it is going to need to be caught red-handed, you know. But my best recommendation to you is that at a time when it's acting up, I would take it to a different shop, maybe somebody that says they specialize in air conditioning, because the recommendation you got is not a reasonable recommendation. If someone's not figuring it out, it isn't even practical to think about replacing the whole air conditioning system in a vehicle. There's components in the dash, there's components under the hood, and it's, you know, it just isn't likely that everything has failed. That's just not a likely scenario. There's an intermittent electrical component or connection somewhere that somebody with knowledge of that system, it's just they need to take a voltmeter and they need to start back, you know, tracing circuits till they find where the power is interrupted. And, you know, it's something that can only be done when it's acting up, but a competent technician is going to be able to diagnose that when it's acting up, and they're going to be able to tell you what component it is and not, you know, not the whole system. It isn't necessarily that it has to be an electrical condition like I'm describing. I mean, the air conditioning system can get plugged up on the inside. It's got little valves it could plug in. Could stop the flow, the circulation of the refrigerant, which would stop it from cooling. But that's also something that with a set of gauges, that would be able to be diagnosed. So there's, you know, someone with more experience than who has looked at it needs to take a look at it while it's acting up, and they'll be able to get to the bottom of that.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, for that question. Rosanna in Madison, go right ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a 2005 Camry XLE with 138,000 miles on it, and recently the windows on the passenger side and the two back windows stopped working. Are these connected in some kind of way?
They may be. You know, one of the most common things that we would see fail on that model of car are the window switches themselves. The master switch in the driver's door that's got the control of all of them is kind of a central location, but then each window switch can fail individually. They were notorious on that model for failing, and, you know, there were different theories I heard over time of this or that causing it. Those were usually related to various chemicals that might be in the air inside the car. Even the little Toyota at one point thought those little scent aerosol device that you'd clip onto a vent had some kind of silicone or something they thought might affect their window switches. I don't think they ever got down to the bottom of what was causing it, but those window switches fail kind of inordinately, you know, too often. And the fact that a couple of them went doesn't mean that there's something major systemic in the whole system going. It's probably just coincidence that two of them have failed or are failing close to each other. And it may be very well, too, that they work intermittently, but sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But and there are different things in that system that could be a problem, but by far the most common thing were the power window switches on the doors themselves, and that's probably what's going on there.
Okay, thanks, Rosanna, for that question. Now, we were talking earlier about pulling a trailer with a car, but a lot of people put their stuff on top of their car. What are some of the things you need to think about when you're putting on a cargo carrier?
Well, one of the most important things to think about is just that you're adding wind resistance. And depending on the car, it may not make much difference, but something like, you know, a hybrid in particular, they're not really designed in most cases to handle much more load in terms of weight or wind resistance than just the passengers in the car. And you add a lot of wind resistance. So depending on the shape of that, I mean, when you look at rooftop carriers, some of them are very aerodynamic, you know, that they're very aero-shaped, and some of them are not. They're just a big black blob up there. So if you're looking at adding something like that, consider going with something more aerodynamic. For one thing, it's going to have less impact on your fuel mileage, and it's going to have less impact on how much power you have, particularly if you're driving in the headwinds. You know, the other thing is just, you know, you want to make sure that whatever you're adding there is designed to be mounted onto that car so that you're not taking chances of either damaging and scratching your roof by how it's mounted or, worst case scenario, having it fall off and become a road hazard for people behind you.
Yeah, that happens a little too often. excuse me. If you're going on a vacation, obviously you want to get the best gas mileage that you can. What are some things that we can do to try to do that?
Number one, check your tire pressures. Most all cars out there have tire pressure warning lights on them anymore, so we kind of just don't really think about that. If I have a tire problem, that light's going to come on and tell me. And while it will come on and tell you, the thing to keep in mind is it's got about a 7-pound threshold. So if the tire pressure in your car is supposed to be 35 pounds, that light's not coming on until you get to 28. And if all your tires are 28 and the light is, or 29 and the light's still off, you're going to get less gas mileage than you'd get if your tire pressures were correct. So even if the light's not on, if you're going to take a trip, even not a bad idea to just get in the habit of semi-regularly checking your tire pressure and making sure that they're at the correct pressure. That correct pressure is listed on a little, about a credit card size plate that's on the driver's door jamb. It'll say, you know, what they should be. Sometimes they're different front and rear, but it'll specifically say what those tire pressures should be. That is probably the biggest thing that's going to affect gas mileage. Secondly, though, an air filter, a dirty air filter, is not necessarily going to make your car run bad. It's not going to be noticeably different how it idles or runs going down the road. But it is likely to affect your gas mileage. So a dirty air filter is the next most likely thing that's going to take a few miles of the gallon away from you. So those are a couple of things that I've seen have significant impact on fuel mileage, and they're easy to check. So,
yeah, we like that. Sam in Stevens Point, go right ahead with your question.
Hi, it's Pam. Stevens Point. I have a 2011 Buick LaCerne. About a year and a half ago, I wound up with a damaged tire where I had to replace two of the tires because you can't put only one on if it's radials. So I got two put on. Then 6 months later, I got the other two put on, and it developed like a shimmy. And it drives you crazy because it happens when it's going about 45 miles an hour or 65 miles an hour. And they've spin balanced the tires numerous times, numerous vendors. And I finally gave up and put new tires on it. But it seems like it's still there.
Well, you know, you were right in thinking that thinking it was a tire, because that's the most common cause of a shimmy like that. But a bent wheel can cause something like that as well. And it's possible that in a brake condition or a wheel bearing condition can cause that. You know, ultimately, you've eliminated tires by replacing them as you have, unfortunately. But, you know, it's the, a bent wheel is something that is often visually obvious. So if you had a bent wheel, I would certainly think when the guys were replacing the tires and balancing them that they would have noticed a wheel moving around like that.
Yeah, and Jim, I hate to cut you off. We can finish that up and we come back from the news. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. This is the Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking with Jim Ward about vehicle maintenance today. Jim retired as service manager at Smart Motors in Madison, where he worked for over 36 years. And remember, coming up after 12:30, we're going to hear about a woman's motorcycle group and how to stay safe on the road, whether you're driving a car or a motorcycle. But first, what questions do you have about your car? The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Jim, we've got a number of callers waiting, but we were quite finished with Pam in Stevens Point. Did you have more to say? I know she did.
Well, I would say this is an 11 Buick LaTourne that had a steering shimmy that we were talking about that Pam has replaced tires on. Sounds like a couple of times trying to get to the bottom of this. And normally a tire balance issue, a tire that's out of round, would be the most common thing. But that, you know, they've well eliminated that. And, it you know, there are different steering and suspension components that can cause this, a hub. There are parts of the drive system and the drive axle that can cause a shimmy to get transferred up to the steering wheel. You know, and basically that car needs to get into a front-end shop that kind of specializes in that. You know, if it were something I was going to be chasing after, the next thing I would want to do is measure runout on the brake rotors with them on the car, which is not easy to do. A front-end shop's going to have the equipment to be able to do that, because that measurement's going to reflect how much runout there is. It may or may not be the brake rotor, because with it done on the car, it's also going to evaluate the hub, and that's another area it can be. But it, you know, unfortunately, as I said, the vast majority of vibration, as Pam described, is going to be tires. But when it isn't tires, it really gets to be a bit tougher diagnostics to get to the bottom of what is causing it, because there's so much interplay between all those components. But that's where I would start.
Okay, and Pam, does that pretty much cover what you wanted to know?
Yeah, they've spin balanced it like four times now, and nobody's come up with a solution with three different shops. So maybe I'll just try a real life
dealership. It's just not tires. They keep swinging at tires, but it's not the tires. There's something deeper than that going on.
Okay, great. Thanks, Pam. Good luck. Next up, Gianni in Montello. Go right ahead.
Yes, I have a 1991 Toyota Camry. It's beginning, it falters, sometimes it stalls at the stop signs, it's hard to start, and it loses power when I go into third gear. Fuel injection, all the ignition components have been changed except the coil and the ignition control module. So even the mechanics are having a hard time figuring this one out. What could possibly be wrong with it? And by the way, I'm getting 25,000 volts on the spark plug.
Well, I think that your idle problem and the power in third gear are probably different problems. On that vintage of Camry, the idle problem we'd often find related to something called an idle air control valve that would get kind of varnished up, and it could cause it intermittently to not want to idle properly like that. And that valve can be cleaned or it can be replaced. Losing power in third gear, you know, there are a lot of different things, and I obviously it doesn't have a warning light on or anything that's giving them a clue which way to go. I would start out here by having that idle air control valve examined on that vehicle, and honestly from there I would probably try something innocuous. If you're not a regular user of a fuel system cleaner, fuel system stabilizer, I would look at getting a good fuel system cleaner that that you could run through the fuel that can help clean out injectors, clean out some of the components in the fuel injection system. That may not get to the bottom of it, but you could spend a lot of time and money trying to diagnose something like this and not make any headway when I've seen so often something simple. There's a lot of different products out there, but Seafoam is one of my favorite ones. Seafoam's an additive you can add to your gas that will both stabilize the gas. You know, if the vehicle sits for a long time, the gas sits for a long time, it keeps the gas from going bad, but it also has solvents in it that'll help clean varnishes out of things like injectors. And, you know, it very well may not solve this problem, but a car that age with a problem like this that's obviously been looked at a few times, they've been digging for it, it doesn't hurt to try it. And I've seen something as innocuous as that resolve these kind of problems several times before. So I'd look at that idler control valve. I try some Seafoam in the fuel and see how you come out with that.
Okay, good luck, Gianni. If you've got a question for Jim, we've got some open lines, 800-642-1234. And Bob and Chitek, what question do you have for us?
Jim, I'm a Camry true believer, been driving Camry wagons since the year 2000, presently driving my 94 Camry with the four-cylinder, 179,000 on it. I'm wanting to know if there's any way to get live data out of this thing. I know it's an OBD1. And you do the paper clip to read the engine codes and such, but is there a way to get live data?
You'd have to have it connected to a computer that watches it while it's running. I mean, you're not going to get it right off of the OBD2-1 system. That's going to give you codes. So, you know, and it's going to be limited what you can get, you know, compared to OBD2 vehicles where you can just see it all right on a screen all at once. It is possible, but it's the old refrigerator-sized machine that you hook up to several different components under the hood and to be able to get at and see that live data.
Okay, thanks, Bob, for the question. So if we're driving along on our vacation, Jim, and I know I've used to hear this a lot about car overheating. Does it still happen? And if it does, what should we be looking for?
Well, the most common reason, well, there are different things that can make a car overheat. Most modern vehicles have an electric cooling fan for the radiator anymore. And depending on your commute, your daily driving, that fan usually does not come on. If you turn the air conditioner on high, it should most certainly come on under that circumstance. But, you know, a lot of people, not everybody uses air conditioning. And if your commute doesn't have a lot of idling and low speed in traffic, in city traffic, there may not be an occasion for that fan to be called on to come on for long periods of time. You know, you may not be asked, you called on to come on at all. But when you go on a highway trip and you're suddenly in a stop and go traffic situation, that could be one cause. So electronic cooling fan. So again, that's something easily checked. You know, before you leave on your trip, turn the air conditioner on high. You should see that fan behind the radiator whizzing and turning, even with the car just sitting still. Low coolant is another thing. You can have an antifreeze leak. That is a very slow leak that you know, in the heat of summer and in pressures, and if you end up, you know, on the interstate or on some highway in a traffic jam for a little while, it can heat it up enough to cause that leak to get worse, and if it leaks down enough and then suddenly you're in a situation where it's overheating. You know, one of the things about the antifreeze system is that you want to be very, very careful once the car is hot. You don't want to check that antifreeze level, you know, on a hot engine because it can spray out of the system and can burn you. So you want to be very careful about trying to do any of that kind of diagnosis yourself. When the engine overheats, the thing that has to be done is you have to leave it sit and wait until it cools down to address anything, to check the fluid level or anything else. But you know, that those are probably the couple of most common things, either the fan's not working right or we've got a loss of antifreeze. But yeah, do it before, have those things checked before the trip. Mm-hmm. Don't pull over with a car that's overheating and go under the hood and start loosening and opening things up.
Oh, yeah, that could be a problem. So is that the best thing to do, is just pull over, wait for things to cool down?
Right. And you know, when they cool down, you know, I remember test driving my car one time. Fortunately, it was for work, and it was test driving my car that had that concern, and ending out on the highway somewhere with it starting to overheat. I ended up sitting there for a while, and you know, ultimately there was a ditch right there full of water, which is not the ideal water you want to put in that. But in the circumstance, I took an empty water bottle that was in the floor of that car, and filled it back up after it cooled down and went back to the shop and flushed it all out and put a good antifreeze in it so that we didn't have to worry about any contaminants that might have gone in it. But, you know, in a worst-case scenario, it doesn't have to be antifreeze you put in there in the summertime. Any water or liquid, you know, you could put in there temporarily and have it flushed out later. But
okay.
If you're in that circumstance, I hope you have a roadside assistance plan and lean on them and don't try to fix that one yourself.
For sure. Okay, we've got some phone calls coming in. Sherry in Spooner, how can we help you?
Hi there. I have a 2013 Subaru Outback, and it consumes oil. It doesn't leak oil, but it consumes it. Any suggestions?
Well, it... That's kind of a known issue on those, and when it's not leaking oil, the oil consumption is either caused by an internal leak in the engine, something like a valve seal allowing oil to run into the engine, or worn piston rings. On a 13 Outback, I think the valve seals were the more common problem, where it leaks in through the cylinder's valves. There's not an easy, cheap fix for that. I don't know what the rate of consumption is. If it's less than a quart to 1,000 miles, I would add oil. I would simply add oil, monitor it, and keep on top of it. You could have the engine overhauled and have those valve seals replaced and have it fixed. And you wouldn't necessarily even have to do a complete engine overhaul. A valve seal leakage is something that can be diagnosed. There's a little camera device they can stick down in the spark plug hole and look at the engine, and not while it's running, but to look to see if oil is running down those. It'll cause a certain appearance that they'll be able to see, but that's probably what it is. And again, depending on the rate of consumption, if it's not in excess to a quart to 1,000 miles, in the meantime I would probably just keep some oil in the car, keep checking it and keep adding, and keep it fill it up every time it gets a quart low.
Okay, thank you, Sherry. Next up, Kathy in Rice Lake. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi. I have a 2001 Mustang GT that has just less than 20,000 miles on it. I only drive it on sunny Sunday afternoons. I keep it housed in the garage over the winter. I leave a trickler on it for the battery, and I fill the car up with gas and put a stabler additive to it. Is there anything, and I get my oil changed once a year. Is there anything else I should do, even yearly or when the spring comes and I start taking it out, to maintain the car at top performance?
You know, you're a rock star with everything you're doing. Those are the basic things that you need to do to stay out of trouble. When it sits, you might want to put a little more air in the tires to keep them from flat spotting. If it sits for months at a time, at least once a year, you want to have all the rest of the fluids checked, the antifreeze, the transmission fluid, the axle oil, that kind of thing. But Kathy, really what you're doing, are the basic things that you really need to do. You are on top of it.
Okay. I think Kathy really loves her 2001 Mustang GT.
Why wouldn't you? An 01 Mustang.
Right.
That just screams road trip.
Exactly. Especially convertible. Thank you, Kathy. Jay in Two Rivers, you're next.
Hi. I've got a 1999 Pontiac Grand Prix with the 3800 Torquemeister V8, and I still only have 47,000 miles on it. About 15,000 miles ago, I had the coolant and the transmission flushed and the fluids replaced. And I've got a very reliable mechanic who says my original hoses for the cooling system do not need replacing yet. And I find that pretty remarkable compared to the cars that I used to own prior to that.
You know, and if he's looking at them and they look like they're in good condition and no cracks or anything, he's probably right. I can't remember the last time I saw a radiator hose fail. You know, gosh, I should find some wood to knock on before I take my next trip or something like that. But you know, and man, all these people calling in today with these classics with low mileage. We've got like a car club of people calling in today. But you know, if you've looked at them, I mean, what you look for are cracks, drying out, signs that the rubber is starting to deteriorate. You know, he's a good mechanic. He's taking a look at them. I don't see them fail often, and I think he's right. If they look good, I don't think you need to worry about them.
Okay, thank you, Jay, and we got your fingers crossed for you. Jim emailed us to ask, how important is it to have the throttle body and fuel injector service completed? He says it does not show up in the Toyota maintenance manual, but the dealer recommended it.
You know, that is one of the more common things that gets added on to the manufacturer's maintenance schedules. If you're not having any problems in the way the engine runs, if it idles fine, it accelerates fine, you don't need to do that. You're, in my opinion, you get the same effect by running some seafoam in your gas every now and then. It's one of those things that, in my opinion, is part of a diagnostic procedure. If you have a car that's not idling right or has other acceleration problems, if you don't have those things going on, generally there are enough detergents in the fuel we run anymore these days to keep the fuel system pretty clean. And, you know, if your fuel vehicle sits for periods of time and you have additional concerns because of that, again, I'd run that seafoam. I believe in seafoam. I think it really can do a lot to clean those systems out and do some of the same things that they're talking about doing in a service. Not having a problem, the service just isn't necessary.
So that this seam foam additive that you've talked about, should everybody think about doing that in their car?
No, I highly recommend it. I mean, there's different products out there. Seafoam is just one I personally happen to like. Stable is another one. STABIL. There are lots of products like that out there. But it's not a bad idea. Particularly. There are different qualities of fuel that you can get at different places, and that's just without having to investigate and find out if the particular supplier of gas station you go to and the fuel they use has the right detergent additives and stuff to keep your fuel system clean. Adding this stuff to the fuel now and then is just a very inexpensive way to stay on top of it.
So should you be thinking about after a certain amount of miles or time period? What's the best way to do that?
You know, it's something that I do at least a couple times a year in the fuel for my vehicles. It's something like for my machines at home, lawnmowers, chainsaws, all of that, whether they're two-cycle or four-cycle, I put it in the fuel that I use on those things, and it's always used in those. But in a vehicle, it's something that I really only look at doing once or twice a year, I think, is sufficient.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds good. And we were talking about gas. Should we use a certain kind of gas for a road trip, or do we just do the stuff we normally use?
Well, sometimes on road trips, you don't end up with a lot of choices, depending on how far you drive and where you're going. Name brand fuels tend to have better quality. Higher volume stations tend to have fuel that's not sitting in the ground as much. I hesitate to say what I would recommend or not recommend. There was a time when I might have said Quick Trip was the last fuel I'd get. But these days, they have joined a top-tier fuel program with a number of other fuel suppliers, and now it's one of the best places you can get it. So, but that top-tier fuel is something you can look for. I couldn't tell you a list of which fuel stations have it, but many of the major brands that you'd see out there do. And so if you look for top tier when it comes to gas, I don't think you can go wrong.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. So we've kind of winding up here. Just wondering what your thoughts are on some of the changes that maybe have happened in the automotive industry in the last few years. Now, you retired a couple years back now. What are you hearing about or seeing that's has changed or is going to be changing?
Well, I'm going on 4 years of, yeah, of retirement, and that's after 40 years in the business. And things, electric vehicles are very controversial, but they're getting more popular. People are taking longer trips with those vehicles, and there are more charging stations available. It's still a technology that is still having the kinks worked out, and the infrastructure for them is part of that as well. But I think it's a trend that's not going to go away. There are people who are adamantly against it and think that the minerals and that you need to make them and the dispose of them later don't justify it. But we have to look for different answers, and I think that we're going to continue to see electric vehicles and hybrid combination vehicles you know, and thank goodness for the early adapters who buy them and help us, the rest of us, work out the kinks for the rest of us.
Right.
You know, those are common. Another very common thing is that the safety drive systems that were often in the background and kind of clunky, but kind of anything from lane departure systems to collision detection and avoidance systems, I mean, these are becoming more common on vehicles. One of the things about them is they can save your life. They're often hardly noticeable as you're driving. But they also make vehicles more expensive to repair, even in like a minor fender bender. So you want to really keep on top of your insurance and make sure you've got appropriate coverage for a vehicle that has those systems on it, because, as I said, even a minor fender bender is going to be far more expensive than it would have been on vehicles prior to those systems being on them, because you have sensors in the bumpers. What might have been a plastic bumper and a simple repair a while ago might be a replacement of a couple of very expensive sensors and a very expensive recalibration process to get it to work with the rest of the system. So I think these systems are great. I think they're life-saving, but they do make vehicles more expensive to manufacture, so more expensive to purchase, and more expensive to repair in the case of collisions and accidents.
Well, that makes a whole lot of sense. Just a question for me with the last few minutes that we have. So I've got a 2012 hybrid. I'm not getting as good a mileage as I used to. Is that normal? Is there something I should be looking at? Or should I just, you know, think about trading it in for another hybrid?
Well, you know, I don't tend to see hybrids lose gas mileage unless something else is going on. I mean, that something else, as we discussed earlier, could be as simple as tire pressures or an air filter. So, you know, you want to look at those basics first. And the other thing, you know, for yourself or anyone else, if you love that car, if you just love that car and you know, for some people, it just every time the odometer hits a certain milestone, they want to take a picture and post it on social media, share it with their friends. And I mean, if you love the car that much, then you know, try some of those basic things and see if you can't get to the bottom of what your fuel mileage loss is. But you know, again, you might want to be one of those early adapters that gets one of the new ones, and you know, you'll have mileage back and probably a bunch of safety systems and toys and stuff that you didn't have on your current car, which. You know, are great things to have.
That's true. I've got over 200,000, so
your favorite playlist for your road trip will work in either vehicle.
I love it. What are you talking about? I listen to WPR everywhere I go, Jim.
Of course.
Thank you so much for being with us, and you'll be back in a few months, and we'll look forward to that. Enjoy your summer.
Great. You too. Thanks, Jill.
You bet. So coming up, we're going to be talking about Women's Motorcycle Group. And we're also going to talk a little bit about staying safe on the road, whether, you know, you're driving the motorcycle or you're driving a car and you need to look out for that motorcycle. So stay with us. Well, now that we've got that earworm in your head, we want to talk about women and motorcycling, because women are the country's fastest growing group of motorcycle riders. And that's according to Motorcycle Industry Council. I'm Joan LeJoe, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. We're talking about motorcycles and a group of women who enjoy riding together. Our guests are Kate Harms and Bridget Whitwer, and they are co-founders of the Madison Lidas, which is a motorcycle collective. And if you love riding your motorcycle, motorcycle, we'd like to hear from you. Why do you love to ride? And maybe you're interested in learning, but you're not quite sure if you're ready. These ladies can help you out. Have you found a supportive community on the road? We'd want to talk to you. 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Kate, Bridget, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the invite.
Thank you.
You bet. So first, Kate, why don't we start with you? Tell us more about the Madison Leaders. Who are you? What's your mission?
Absolutely. So the Leaders is a women's motorcycle collective. It was started in 2015 in southern Utah with a few women in the Utah area who learned to love riding and learned to love the camaraderie and support that they got from a women's motorcycle group. So they expanded the Leaders internationally. There's chapters all over America, all over the world, actually. So Bridget and I are here representing the local Madison chapter. And the Leaders' mission is really to inspire and empower women through community and our shared love of motorcycles and the road.
Okay. And how, are there other chapters besides yours in Wisconsin?
Yep, there are four chapters currently in Wisconsin. We've got Milwaukee, Waukesha, and the Fox Valley area.
Okay, so someone up in Eau Claire wants to start one in that area, there's an opening, right?
Absolutely.
How many members do you have in the Madison Leaders?
A good question. I think we're up to between 80 and 90 members right now.
Wow, that's a lot. That's more than I thought I was going to hear from you. Has that increased a lot in just the last year or two, or how long has it taken?
Yeah, our chapter has only been around for a couple years now. So in the past two, we've really grown a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And while we have a lot of members, you know, who like to participate with us, you know, via social media and a little engagement in the chat, I'd say for the average riding event, we have about 10 to 12 that show
okay.
up. So we're still a pretty modest group for
sure, rides. Sure. Now, Bridget, you and Kate are two of the co-founders of the Madison chapter. Why did you see the need for an inclusive motorcycle group in the area?
Yeah, so we came together in 2021, and me, there was Christine and Kayla and Stevie originally as well, and there is another group, as Kate had mentioned, in Milwaukee. So I had known about the Milwaukee girls. There's several events that they help out with, Flat Out Friday, the Mama Tried Show. So I met them, I hung out with them when I was in Milwaukee, but all of these events that they would have, their rides or social meetups, all took place around the Milwaukee area. I myself am from Greene County, so getting over to Milwaukee just wasn't feasible 99% of the time. So I was riding around Milwaukee on my way back, actually, and I met a couple other girls, and I was like, oh, hey, where are you guys headed? And they were headed back to Madison. And I said, oh, my gosh, there's other women in Madison who ride. And that's how we kind of just started that conversation. And then in a couple other of our random meetup, we're like, we should just start a Madison chapter. And it was relatively easy to start our own chapter in Madison. So that's kind of what we did. And we've just been growing and kind of snowballing from there.
Okay. How is the collective different from a traditional motorcycle club?
I love this question. I think a bunch of people, men and women, are a little intimidated about trying to join a motorcycle club. You kind of have this, maybe not so much a negative, but an intimidating thing of you have to have a certain bike, you have to have a certain image, you have to, you know, be able to ride at this expertise level, where the collective is so much different than that. It's so much, I would say, more open-ended. You can be on any bike, you can be on any riding level, you can have any riding image. You know, we have some girls who are riding in full leathers. I have this big pink fuzzy coat that I love to bring around. So it's so different, but it's, we're all there for the same reason of we're all on two wheels and we're all just having fun.
Mm-hmm.
There's no shaming. There's no, oh, you can't keep up with us. There's none of that.
Mm-hmm. How did you each get into riding yourselves? Kate, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I started riding as a passenger with my husband, who had a bike for a long time. So I started off in the back seat,
And I thought, on a whim, I'll just take the rider safety course, see if I like it. If that's cool, it's cool. If I hate it, I'll, you know, that'll be the end of it. So I took the rider safety course. It was a wonderful experience. I learned to love being on the front seat, and I learned I didn't have to look at the back of my husband's head on a ride anymore. And it's so empowering, and I loved the freedom of it. So just by simply on a whim taking that course, that's how I got into it. So I've been riding a bit over, I think, 11 years now.
Oh, what about you, Bridget?
So I first started when I was a kid on a little PW50, so a little dirt bike. And I kind of graduated up into a couple bigger bikes. And then I got married, started having kids, and hauling a bike to the motorcycle track just wasn't, again, feasible just because of time constraints. So I got a little bike out of a barn and was able to fix it up. I call it my electrical tape and dream bike. And I was able to just kind of putz around on a Saturday afternoon where I had an hour free with no kids. I could just go get my quick little speed fix. And I've since graduated up to bigger bikes, but I've kind of always been on two wheels in some capacity.
Sure. I had a mini bike as a kid, too, so I appreciate that. And you're right. It was so freeing, and it was just so fun to go fast. Is that what you love about motorcycle riding?
Go ahead, Kate. You go.
Sure. Yeah, for me, it's a bit of the freedom. It's being disconnected from everything else. You know, unlike being in a car, you have to be focused on the road. And being on a motorcycle is such a full sensory experience. I just got back from a really cool trip in the Smoky Mountains down in North Carolina, and it was so fun to ride in and out of the hills, and you realize the temperature changes, you know, every 20 seconds, and you're so in tune to even, like, the texture of the road. You feel it all over.
Mm-hmm.
It's far different than a road trip in a car.
For sure. You can't eat snacks. What about you, Bridget? What do you love most about it?
I think the two things, piggybacking off of what Kate said, you are disconnected. You know, when I put on my helmet, it's a great little, like, time for me to really think about my day, think about my plans, process through some things that I just have rattling around in my brain. Sometimes I'll play music, but sometimes I'll just ride in silence. You know, and if my phone buzzes, I can't answer it. So I'm totally disconnected in my own zone. And then there also is, like Kate said, you can feel more. You can feel the texture of the road. You can feel the temperature changes. I think my dad probably heard this from a fortune cookie or somewhere else, but he had said that when you're in the car, it's like you're watching a movie through your windshield. But when you're on a bike, you're starring in that movie.
Wow. I love that. I love that. Mm-hmm. So I think that a lot of women are not very tall, not necessarily strong. I mean, obviously, this isn't everyone, but that tends to be the case. And so motorcycles are a little intimidating in that they're usually for taller people and stronger people. What do you say to people who say that to you? Go ahead, Kate.
Yep, I am that 5'3" short-legged gal who felt that way, too. So I will say it is a bit more effort to sit on bikes, try out what works for you. I've been lucky enough to be connected with a bunch of really good mechanics who are fabulous at finding a new seat for me, finding handlebars that are a good reach for me. So it sometimes takes a little bit of effort to find the right bike that fits for you, but they certainly exist. Don't give up.
Okay. Bridget?
Yeah, I think it's funny. Of the current co-founders for the Madison Litas, Kate and I are definitely the shortest. I'm also about 5'3".
Okay.
And for me, it's having been on a large, taller dirt bike, I'm not too scared about being on my tippy toes or only being able to touch with one foot. But my initial fear, and still in the back of my brain, is if this bike tips over, how am I going to be able to get it back up?
Right.
Especially if I'm not in a group, if I'm by myself, if I'm at a stop sign and people behind me are waiting. But it's really about the bike, I think. There's several bikes that you can get. The bike I'm currently on is a 650, and I've tipped that over a couple times. And it didn't look pretty, but I was able to get it up myself. So I think having that confidence, knowing if this bike does tip over, I know I can get it up myself, is a huge game changer. So I would say,
like Kate said, there are bikes out there. You just kind of sit on them and test them out.
Mm-hmm, that makes sense. So I understand that you welcome members who are beginners or even don't even have their own bike. So what advice do you have for someone who's looking to get into motorcycle riding? Go ahead, Bridget.
That one too.
Well, whomever. Oh, okay. That's fine.
Kate, if you're ready, go ahead.
Sure. We call these folks the moto curious.
Okay.
If you are moto curious, I would say a wonderful first step is just taking the rider safety course. They offer them in a lot of different locations, and I know that was my intro experience, and it was fabulous. They certainly cater to all ability levels. I had zero motorcycle experience when I walked in. I didn't even know how to drive a manual transmission. They're really good at starting at all levels. And through that rider experience, you know, you go through all the basics, of course, and you come out with just that small amount of confidence it takes to start. So I would suggest that. And for the women out there, the women moto curious, join up with the Alitas or, you know, connect with a fellow female riders in your area. It's really helpful to build that confidence and connect with a community that is similar to you.
Okay. Anything to add?
So, Kate, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe at a bunch of these different classes, they have different style bikes, too. Is that right?
Yep, exactly. So they have some Harleys, they have some sport bikes, they have some dirt bikes. There's a variety for what your flavor is.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
I think for someone who doesn't know their flavor, that's just a great place to start.
Okay.
And you don't need a bike. You don't need your own bike. They'll supply that for you.
And where do you find that? Who can, you know, where do you go to get those classes?
Harley is a really good place to offer that. They have a lot of Harley dealerships offer that. Or if you just simply Google motorcycle safety in your area, a whole lot of areas will pop up. For example, I did mine through MATC.
Great. We're talking with Kate Harms and Bridget Whitwer. They are co-founders of the Madison Lita's Motorcycle Collective. Do you have a question about their group? A question about riding a motorcycle? We'd love to hear from you. Number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hope you can join us again tomorrow on Garden Talk. Diana Allfuth is back, and she'll talk about what to do with those diseased plants and leaves and branches that we take out of our garden, how to dispose of those. And we'll also talk a little bit about how to create a rock garden. But right now, we are talking about Madison Women's Motorcycle Collective. It's called the Madison Litas. And we're just talking about beginners and where you can go. But let's talk a little bit about equipment. What's the best thing, and what do you really need as a beginner? Bridget, go ahead and take that.
Yeah, this is a great question. I actually hit a deer 2 years ago on my bike, but I was fully geared up, which I believe is the only reason that I'm still here today, because of my helmet. But I would say that you don't have to have the top of the line fancy matching everything. So when I went down after I hit my gear, I had a helmet, gloves, motorcycle jacket, and some boots. And I was just in jeans. I got a little bit of road rash because my jeans were cut up. But you don't need to necessarily have, you know, the $600 jacket. I think the jacket I had was $100 from Amazon. And my gloves were $25. I think I got them at like the bargain bike barn in Edgerton. So you don't have to have top of the line expensive gear, but you do need to be protected.
Mm-hmm. And as far as helmets go, Kate, are there some that you really want to avoid?
Yeah, the answer is yes. You want to make sure you have a helmet that is rated, DOT rated helmet. I think you can get some silly cute ones that cover kind of the top of your noggin, but you really want to make sure you have a full covered, either a three quarter or a full face helmet with that DOT rating.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you would add to what Bridget was saying?
No, agreed what she said.
Okay.
solid boots that'll stay on your feet and some good gloves that'll cover your hands.
Sure. You must kind of cringe when you see people running around. I mean, I've seen such, especially women, you know, with cutoff shorts and very skimpy tops and flip-flops. I mean, how dangerous is that?
The flip-flops are crazy to me. It's really hard to shift with a flip-flop, I imagine.
Right. I would think so, too. Well, these are generally riders, but still, it doesn't take much for you to really hurt yourself, even if you're going slow, right?
Yeah, I think road rash, and aside from, like, the impact of hitting the ground, road rash can happen, you know, if you're just in a parking lot and you tip over, your elbow could get across, you know, the cement, which hurts.
Yes, it does. And it doesn't look pretty. We had a listener called. She couldn't stay with us, but they're wondering how the Litas are different from the stilettos on steel. Kate, you want to take that?
Sure. I'm actually not sure if I have a great answer for that. I think the mission of both groups is probably super similar. I can only speak to the Litas in that we are a no membership dues requirement. You don't have to pay a fee. You show up for as many or as few events as you want, and we're kind of a laid-back, come-and-go-as-you-please group.
Okay. Bridget, are you familiar with Stilettos on Steel?
I believe when I way back when I was looking for girls motorcycle groups, I didn't see a Stilettos on Steel in the area. So I think that's why we leaned towards the Litas originally, just because they have a very active chapter in Milwaukee.
Okay.
But I don't know enough to say exactly how they're different, other than maybe how active they are in this area specifically.
Okay. Well, if there's anybody out there who's a member of the Stilettos on Steel, give us a call, 800-642-1234, and we'll get your side of this. We do have a call, Tim in Hollandale. Go ahead, Tim.
Hi, I used to ride motorcycles back in the 80s and 90s. I used to be in a motorcycle club. Still ride, but not in a club. But if you have kids and you're wanting to teach them how to ride, starting them out on a dirt bike is probably the best way to teach a youngster when they get on the road, because they'll cross any hazard on riding a dirt bike that you would come across on the road, potholes, slick areas. So that'll give you you'll be a better rider if you ride a dirt bike first. And then the other thing I was going to say is bike size. When I used to ride in a club and when we used to build bikes, everybody wanted the biggest, baddest bike they could find, and a lot of people couldn't handle the bike. They were either too small for the bike was too big for them, or too much power. If you can't back up your bike or lift your bike, that's not the bike for you.
Mm-hmm.
That bike falls on you in the road, you become, you know, you'll get yourself killed. So that's kind of what I wanted to say, I guess.
Great. Thank you, Tim. We appreciate that. Ladies, anything to add to that?
I agree with everything he said.
Okay. You know, safety obviously is important when we're operating any vehicles. But when you're on your motorcycle, how do you drive differently from when you're actually in your car? Go ahead, Bridget.
Yeah, so I think I definitely am way more proactive about things as far as, like, when I'm coming up to an intersection or roundabouts especially. I am hawkeyeing whatever vehicle is on the left, and I'm usually staring at their front tire because I can tell based on what that rim is doing if it's inching forward or if it's completely stopped. And I'm definitely keeping an eye on that, and then I'm gauging what I'm doing. You know, do I speed up to make sure I am officially way ahead of this car before it gets into the roundabout, or do I slow way down so if they don't see me, I have enough time to come to a complete stop? So I think in a car, I'm a little bit different because I feel like I have not necessarily more of a right on the road, but I know that I'm more easily seen versus on a motorcycle. I always assume that somebody's not seeing me.
Oh, that's a way of good. That's a good way to put it. Assuming that you're not seen, I like that. Kate, what happens if you're in the, you know, the weather? You're really exposed in the wind and the rain. And I mean, I don't know if you go out in the wintertime, but there could also be snow. So, how do you adjust how you drive with those situations?
Sure. I think the two strategies, there's either avoid, have really good radar on your phone and, you know, avoid your route when rain is coming in, if possible, or you just need to be really prepared for it. And by prepared, I mean have the right gear. You probably need a windshield on your bike. You need to have a full face helmet. Rain gear is helpful. And make sure that you're wearing something that's reflective so other people can see you during darker weather. Avoid or gear up.
Right, right. You know, I've heard, and I'm sure most people have heard the phrase, share the road. From your perspective, what does that mean, Bridget?
I think it's kind of just like with bicycles, you're supposed to move over and give them a little more space when they're riding on the side of the road. From a motorcycle perspective, I ask for the same kind of thing of please don't be right behind me. You know, don't try to like merge thinking, oh, I can totally fit in there. It would be like, share the road. Give me my little bubble, please, is my take on it.
Mm-hmm. Kate, how much room are we talking about here?
I think with motorcycles, right, drivers should really anticipate giving even more room than you would to a four-wheeled vehicle in front of you. Few reasons for that. You know, if I'm on a motorcycle approaching a curve and I suddenly see that there's gravel in the road, I'm going to significantly slow down and take that curve a little slower than probably a four-wheeled vehicle from would be. So I think drivers behind a motorcycle should be aware of that extra space, you know, to accommodate for some of those road variability. And also just from a visibility perspective, too, if there's a car, you know, riding really, really close behind me, other traffic around me is probably not going to see me as easily. Mm-hmm. So it helps with visibility to give extra space.
Now, I've noticed just in the last year, a couple of times I've had motorcyclists go between me and the lane, you know, like two-lane road, go in between when traffic is slow. Is this a new rule or are these people doing something illegal? Kate?
In Wisconsin, that's illegal.
Okay.
It really varies from state to state. A few places like California, for example, we call that lane splitting, and that is legal. In the state of Wisconsin, it is not.
Okay, so they could get a ticket for doing something like that.
Yep.
Okay. We did get a call from Jason in Platteville. He couldn't stay with us, but he says the Stilettos on Steel Southwest Wisconsin chapter is really great and really active. So, not a whole lot of information, but obviously he likes it. Let's talk about men. I'm assuming you don't have any men in your group, but are they welcome? You are inclusive? Bridget?
Sure. So we have a couple of rides a month, and we'll designate when we have a ride or a meetup, we'll say if this is specifically for members only or if it's for members and their guests. We do have a couple guys who do ride with us occasionally, and we always love it when they come along. There are, for a variety of reasons, some rides where we just like to have just us girls. Mm-hmm. So it kind of goes both. So we don't have any men who are official Lido's members, but we do have some who are our good friends.
Okay. So to be a member, you just sign up, I'm assuming? Kate?
Yeah, so through the... Oops, sorry. Go ahead, Kate.
Sorry.
Yeah, there's a few ways to join. The first one is we have an app for that, actually. If you download the Collective by the Lidas, it's an app that helps you search all of the active Lidas chapters around the world. You can drill down into Wisconsin and join a specific Wisconsin chapter through that app.
Okay.
Or,
go ahead.
Yep, or our Madison chapter is also really active on the GroupMe app. So if you have GroupMe, you can search out the Madison Lidas and ask to join us through that group. And that's often where we'll post most of our event information.
Okay, and so how many events do you have, and are they just rides? Bridget?
So we typically have at least one ride a month, and then we try to do at least one meetup a month. Granted, during the winter, we don't have rides, but we do have, like, dinners. We had a Galentine's in February. That was a lot of fun. And then I know coming up here in July, it's already the middle of July, but we still have two rides coming up. So during the summer, we have more rides. And then in the winter, we have at least some kind of meetup. Usually not on a bike, though.
Great. And do you have a website, or where can people get more info?
So the Collective app and then the group meet. We also are active on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay.
You can shoot us a message through either of those socials, and someone will grab it and get back to you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both, Kate Harms and Bridget Whitwer. We really appreciate you being with us and telling us about your group. Thank you so much.
Yeah, for having us.
Thank
Great
you.
Chatting with you. Thanks.
You bet. Thank you for joining us today. This and all our other shows, of course, are a team effort. We want to thank our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Petnod, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our regular host, of course, Larry Mueller. I'm executive director Jill Nadeau, and I want to thank Trina LaSouza for filling in as our technical director today. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. Stay well.